from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. As long as there have been humans, there have been parents. But parenting, that's new, like really new. The developmental psychologist Allison Gopnik says the word parenting first popped up in the late 50s, and it was a model for how to raise your kids to get them into a good school and make them a productive member of society. But it turns out parenting, quote unquote, doesn't make any sense from an evolutionary standpoint. Gopnik says we humans were not evolved to shape and control the lives of our kids. We were designed to give them a safe space so they could go off and explore. So, not a carpenter, a gardener. That's where she got the title of her book, The Gardener and the Carpenter. Today in the program, Allison Gopnik is joining us to talk about what science tells us about the relationship between parents and children. After the news.
Purchase the books that you hear featured on Radio West by clicking the IndieBound, Amazon, or Audible links included with each show at RadioWest.org. A portion of proceeds from these affiliate partners supports Radio West. While you're there, you can check out all the show archives. Thanks for listening.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In her latest book, the developmental psychologist Allison Gopnik writes, "Parenting is a terrible invention." And we'll get to what she means by parenting, quote unquote, during the show today. Basically, it's this model that emerged in the 60s and 70s of moms and dads treating parenthood with the same kinds of intentions and goals they were used to seeing in their schools or their work, that is, trying to control the outcome in the lives of their kids. But Gopnik says that doesn't really make sense if you look into human evolution and the way this relationship between adults and children developed. In the book, Gopnik argues parents weren't designed to shape their children's lives. They were designed to make a safe space so the kids could shape their own lives. But, and this is important, her book isn't just about letting the grown-ups go with the flow, because parents, of course, she says, do have a profound influence on young people. Teaching children, she writes, is certainly important, but trying to shape the outcome too much is just going to be futile and self-defeating. Today in the program, Allison Gopnik is joining us to talk about her book. It's called The Gardener and the Carpenter, what the new science of child development tells us about the relationship between parents and children. Gopnik is a professor of psychology and affiliate professor of philosophy at the University of California, Berkeley. She writes the Mind and Matter column for the Wall Street Journal, and she's joining us today from the studios of UC Berkeley, the Graduate School of Journalism there. Allison Gopnik, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, great to be here.
So I guess I wanted to begin with when you first started thinking about the ideas in this book. What got you started on the concept?
Well, what happened was two things happened. One was that I got very interested in this really exciting new science that has been coming out in the last 15 years or so, both in evolutionary biology and also in the kind of developmental lab science that I do. And the picture that came out of that work, the picture of the relationships between parents and children, was strikingly different from the picture that had become prevalent in the culture. And at about the same time, I became a grandmother. I now have three adorable grandchildren. So I was kind of plunged back into the world of taking care of children. And it was really striking that this scientific work about relationships between parents and children looked so different from this prevailing cultural picture of parent relations between parents and children. And it was also rather striking that even in if you compared my grandchildren and my own children, being a parent seemed to have become much more anxious and difficult and full of guilt and worry than it had in my day and I think in most of human history.
Yeah. It's nice how kind of personal the book can be at times. You write about Augie, one grandchild in particular. I thought that was a nice touch. And I think it, as we sort of come back around to the end of the book and the values of children and those kinds of things, I think these are important insights, the personal part. Are you ever reluctant about that as a scientist also telling the personal part?
Well, of course, it's tricky because you want to talk about science, which is something that's generalizable and something that you can use to talk about all children. But actually, one of the things that I talk about in the book that I think is really interesting about our relationship to children is that when we love a child, it's so specific. It's so much my Augie and my Georgie that are the amazing special children unlike any others. And of course, we all know that all the other children who are out there have grandmothers who feel the same way about them. That's sort of comic. It's like the Lake Wobegon children who are all above average. But I think it actually says something deeper. It says something deeper about this really amazing unconditional commitment that we have to this child, kind of no matter what that child is like. Yeah. And in the book, I talk about some of the scientific and evolutionary origins to that amazing unconditional commitment.
Yeah.
So I think in general, the point of doing science is to tell us things about the things that we care about, the things in our everyday life. And scientists should let people know that what they're doing isn't just in an ivory tower. It actually speaks to the things that we're all thinking about all the time.
Mm. But before we get to some of the science, the biological stuff, let's talk about some of the social stuff, some of the social changes that really play into all of this. As you explain in the book, there has always been parenting. But the word parenting or the concept parenting is pretty new. And it, you say it emerged, the word parenting, 1958, which is interesting that you could pinpoint it like that. But explain that, this word that appears, and what are some of the forces that are going on that makes parenting as a concept relevant?
Well, people had occasionally on and off used parenting as a verb for a long time. And of course, the word parent is very old and the word mother and father are as old as English itself.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing that happened in the late 1950s, and Merriam-Webster places it at 1958, is that there was this sudden explosion in the use of the word. And particularly, the word came to mean something very particular. It came to mean this process of getting expertise, techniques, tips, apps that would let you shape your child to come out a particular way. And it's interesting, if you think about the word mothering, which after all was around even earlier, mothering doesn't mean the same thing as parenting.
Yeah.
Parenting is particularly about this idea of that being a parent is a kind of profession that you need professional skills for. And when you look at the Google engram of how often this occurs, there's just this exponential increase in the end of the 20th century that's still going on. So that word by itself is just a word, but it comes with a picture. And that picture is that parenting is this kind of goal-directed enterprise oriented towards a child. And, you know, after all, we don't wive our husbands and we don't child our parents. And even on Facebook, we don't friend our friends. So there's something about that word that turns a relationship, being a parent of this child, into a kind of goal-directed work.
Mm. In the 20th century, there were these changes happening where you have smaller families, you have more mobility. And it seems that the kind of the crucial change is that people started to become first-time parents later in life. And explain what that meant, because that seems like an important point to all of this.
Right. So then there's this puzzle. Why did this happen at the end of the 20th century?
Yeah.
And I think the answer is that for most of human history, the way that you learned how to take care of a child was by taking care of children.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time you had children of your own, you would have been part of a big family. You would have taken care of your younger siblings. You would have watched your aunts and your uncles and your cousins taking care of children. So by the time you were having your own children, you'd had lots of experience with children. And what happened at the end of the 20th century was the shrinking family and greater mobility and older parents meant that really for the first time in history, you had people who had children when they'd spent 20 years working and going to school, but hadn't really taken care of children before.
Mm.
So it was kind of natural that they should think that taking care of children was the same sort of thing as working and going to school, that if you just got the manual and read it and implemented it, you could do a good job at this new job. And that's really different from what happened in most of our history when caring for children was just part of what it meant to be human.
Yeah. One of the things you explore in the book early on is that a lot of the stuff that parents focus on these days, a lot of hand-wringing over sleep training or whether or not you should let your kids sleep with you in the bed or, you know, making them do extra homework or whether to be a tiger. All of that stuff you say may have some effect in the short term for sure, but it doesn't really have any impact on what your kids will become as adults. It only has marginal effects, you say. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, the studies show that at best, all those intentional small variations in what we do with our children that are the focus of parenting, the things that we sort of set out to do and decide to do, have tiny effects on what children are like when they grow up. On the other hand, actually being a parent, actually caring for children, it has overwhelming effects because children depend on us just to stay alive. So the irony is that the things that really matter, things like having a parent who is connected to a child and has enough resources to be with that child and can provide a safe space for that child, all those things that really matter, we aren't paying very much attention to. And the things that don't matter very much, the little differences in how middle-class parents treat their kids, those are the things that are the focus of a billion-dollar industry. And if we took that, you know, if we could take that, take the $1 billion in that industry and make sure that that say the 20% of American children growing up in poverty really did have enough resources to be cared for, yeah, I think that would make an enormous difference. And it's an irony that we put all this focus and time and attention and worry on these small things, and we are not paying attention to the big things, at least for lots of parents.
Yeah.
And I think this picture should be both reassuring and liberating for parents, because I think parents increasingly have this picture that what they have to do when they have children is basically start this new job that they aren't very well prepared for, take on this new profession of being a parent. And what the science says is that you can be the person that you are, you should be the person that you are, and be a parent at the same time. And the way children will learn is by watching and observing and interacting with the person that you are, not this other professional parenting person.
Yeah. I think that's an important point, the idea of this being reassuring, because I'm guessing there are probably more than a few parents who worry that a book like this is just going to be another one of those that scolds them about the fact that they're doing it wrong.
I've joked that the canonical interview that I've had has been some people saying, oh, yeah, I completely agree with that. You know, there isn't a recipe for making your children come out a particular way, and then saying, except just one thing. Could you tell us what the recipe is for making your children come out?
Exactly.
And of course, we all care desperately about our children, and we all want them to come out to have happy lives at the end. There's no question about that. The book is not saying, here's another formula. You're doing it wrong. Here's another formula. In fact, what the book is saying is that if you follow your intuitions and love your children and pass on your values, you're doing it right. And your children have these incredibly powerful learning mechanisms. They're the ones who do most of the work. They're the ones who go forward into the world. And part of the moral of the book is that by giving up some of that sense that you have to be in control all the time, you can actually end up having a more nourishing, positive relationship with your children in the moment. Your children and parents, I hope, can thrive as parents and children without always worrying about what's going to happen 20 years from now, which is something we don't know very much about.
Exactly. And I think it was interesting, too, how important, this surprised me, how important traditions and rituals are in the scheme of things.
Yeah, well, I talk in the book about these central sort of paradoxes that make caring for children a really interesting relationship, an interesting activity, quite unlike any other thing that we do as human beings. Mm-hmm. And one of them that has really become very clear in the science is that children are tremendously sensitive to the values and traditions and rules that parents have. So parents worry about, you know, what can I do to let children know what the rules are? Children are spontaneously extremely good at picking up what rules are. That doesn't necessarily mean that they always follow them, but they're picking up that information. They're figuring out what's important, what isn't important, and even quite subtle, unconscious things about what we do, the way we talk to children, our tone of voice, the way we demonstrate something. That's all full of tremendous amounts of information for the child about what's this culture like that I've grown up in? What's this community like? What's important to these people? And again, all that in the science has much more impact than any of the conscious changes in what we do that are the focus of parenting. But of course, the interesting thing is that because we humans are cultural beings, what we do is take all those values and rules and ideas that we learn from our parents, and then we completely mix them up. Yeah. We reshape them. We turn them into something completely different and unexpected. And that, in fact, is the whole point of childhood. So even if we could shape our children to be exactly like us, or even if we could shape our children to be exactly the way that we want, we would have defeated the whole purpose of childhood by doing that.
Yeah.
Childhood is about novelty and innovation and exploration. And one of the things that you, one of the tensions you have to just live with as a parent is you're passing on your values, but you know that your children are going to revise and reshape those values, and that's all good. That's what has let human beings make the progress they have.
Kids are evolved to overthrow or revise their evolutionary inheritance. It's just, I guess we just have to come to terms with that. Right?
Yeah. And I think if you think, again, I think thinking about it that way is kind of reassuring and liberating. One of the things I say is, you know, we get to watch our children marching ahead of us into the future that we don't know about and can't reach. And sometimes that's a little sad because they're going on ahead and they occasionally, you know, kind of wave back at us as they go forward. But it's also a way that we parents can live on in the future with our children in the future in all of its unexpected complexity and dynamism and variability. And I think that's a much better, more satisfying way of thinking about children than thinking about it as a job that we're always failing at.
Yeah. I really like the analogy that you make in the book early on, saying that parenting is like what happened to food in this country. So basically, traditions were kind of replaced by prescriptions. And this is how you put it in the book. An act of spontaneous and loving care became instead a management plan. But talk about that correlation, because I liked this. I thought this helped sort of me figure this out. The way we started to be so intent about food, we had the same kind of intention about children, and the reaction wasn't great in either case.
Yeah. So what the problem that we face, both in the case of food and in the case of caregiving, is that, again, for most of human history, we had traditions about food and about caregiving that were pretty good, that did a pretty good job most of the time, worked pretty well for most cultures and communities. And they were different in different places. You might eat pasta in one place and pot stickers in another. But, you know, by and large, people managed to be reasonably healthy. Then what happened was in the 20th century, again, the same kind of break from tradition meant that we were omnivores. We could choose out of millions of things to eat, and we became obsessed with whether the things that we were eating were healthy for us or not healthy for us. And the irony is that doing that actually seems to have made everybody less healthy instead of more healthy. Now, the same sort of thing, I think, has happened with caregiving, where these spontaneous traditions that were very varied and involved different kinds of values and different kinds of ways of taking care of children kind of collapsed. And the question now, I think, in both areas is, can we rebuild institutions? Can we make things now that will be a kind of replacement for that spontaneous context that we had in the past? And, you know, we can try and say some general things about eating, Michael Pollan's, you know, eat plants and not too much. And I think sort of the equivalent of that for caregivers is trust your intuitions, muddle through, and hope for the best.
Right.
That's the best summary. And the trusting your intuitions is important because what our intuitions tell us is to love our children in this amazing, uncommitted, deep, profound, individual-specific way, even though we don't know how they're going to turn out.
Yeah.
And they tell us to pass on our values and rules and ideas, even though we know that our children are going to reshape those values and ideas. And they tell us to try to provide a relatively safe and stable environment for our children when they're growing up, even though we know the whole point of that safe and stable environment is for the children to be able to take risks and have adventures and do new things. So that's a kind of summary of what I think real caregiving as opposed to parenting is all about. And, you know, I think that fits people's intuitions pretty well. That's what we kind of spontaneously do. That's not something we need people to go out and tell us to do.
Allison Gopnik is with us. Her book is The Gardener and the Carpenter, What the New Science of Child Development Tells Us About the Relationship Between Parents and Children. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about quote-unquote parenting, which is an ancient experience, of course, but kind of a new concept. Alison Gopnik is with us. She uses evolutionary biology and child development in her latest book to make a case that parents should think less like carpenters, more like gardeners. The gardener and the carpenter, what the new science of child development tells us about the relationship between parents and children, is the name of the book. Alison Gopnik is joining us today from the studios of UC Berkeley, the Graduate School of Journalism there. There's an evolutionary biological component to all of this, of course. And you say that the central scientific idea lies in this idea of disorder. Explain that.
Yeah, so anyone who's ever spent any time at all with preschoolers knows that one thing that you can say for sure about little children is they're messy. They create a lot of chaos.
Yeah.
And traditionally, people have seen that as being a bug rather than a feature of childhood. And what some of the new science, including work that we've done in my lab, suggests is it's actually the opposite, that the unpredictability and variability and difference, both in the sense that individual children are all really different from one another and in the sense that when children are little, they try out all sorts of new ways of thinking about the world or acting on the world. Those things are really crucial to human progress. It's because we have so much mess, so much randomness and variability and unpredictability that we can adapt to changing circumstances. So, you know, go back to that food analogy, part of the reason why I talked about the garden. We used to think that the best way to grow food, for example, the best way to farm was put all your investment and resources in, you know, that one potato that you filled up with fertilizers and pesticides to make it be the biggest potato it could possibly be and have a whole field full of those potatoes. Now, it turns out that's a terrible recipe for being a farmer. And the reason is that what you need to do when you're gardening or farming is create an ecosystem, create lots of diversity, lots of different kinds of plants in lots of different circumstances. And that kind of very diverse, changeable system, that's the kind of system that can be resilient in the face of change. And one of the interesting things from an evolutionary perspective is that actually the thing that made us human was the fact that the climate became much less predictable and our environments became much less predictable. So we're really, our evolutionary niche is the unknown. We're adapted for things that we don't know, that we can't predict. And childhood, the fact that we have this very, very long protected period, much longer than any other species, seems to be a really crucial part of that evolutionary program. So the idea is that in that long period of childhood where we're investing so much time and energy into just keeping children alive, as I say, twice as long as chimpanzees or our closest primate relatives, what's happening? What's that for? Well, what's happening is that those children get a chance to learn and explore and consider new possibilities without having to worry about what's going to happen tomorrow, about whether they're actually going to get food or whether they're going to be taken care of. And that picture is that childhood is all about messiness and exploration and innovation. And what we do as parents is provide this space of love and support and unconditional commitment and kind of give the children the materials they need to explore.
One of the things you write about is the importance of alternating between these periods of exploration and exploitation. I wanted you to talk a little bit about that. Younger brains explore, older brains exploit, basically.
Right. So we've collaborated with people in computer science, and in computer science and in neuroscience, they have this nice phrase about this balance between exploration and exploitation. So the problem is, if you're a creature like a human that can do lots of different things, and you have a new problem to solve, you have to decide, do I want to just get a quick and dirty solution to this that'll work quickly, something pretty close to what I already have, or do I want to go outside the box, brainstorm, try something completely new? And the trouble is that those two strategies intrinsically have a kind of trade-off between them. You can't do both of them at the same time, and there's no principle about which one is best overall. And the way that people, that computer scientists solve this problem is, first you give system a period of just exploring, finding out new things, figuring out what the world is like. And then you can take all that information that you learned in the first phase, in that exploration phase, and you can put it to use to exploit, to actually become a good actor and make things happen. And in the book, I talk about the way that neuroscience suggests that these young brains, these babies' brains, are making enormous numbers of new connections. They're very good at learning. They're very very plastic, as neuroscientists say, very flexible. But as anyone who has tried to get a three-year-old to preschool will tell you, they're not very good at actually doing just one thing at a time and focusing and doing long-term planning. When you look at the adult brain, the connections that are there have become stronger and more efficient. But the adult brain has a much harder time changing. Now, it's not impossible for an adult brain to change. And one of the things I say is I think some of the things that we do as adults, like art and science, are kind of opportunities for us to go back to that playful childhood state. But certainly, if you compare an adult brain to a child's brain, the adult brain really seems to be designed to exploit, do things fast, do things effectively. And the child's brain seems to be designed to explore, to think about possibilities. You know, maybe that little piece of fluff that's on the carpet is actually just as interesting as getting out of the door and going to preschool.
You explained that the rise of parenting has accompanied the decline of the street. Kids just playing in the street or in a public playground or in a neighborhood or even recess. So that's sort of, it's the idea of just letting your kids go out and be bored.
Mm-hmm.
Are we seeing, I don't know, can we measure that decline?
Well, I have a whole chapter in the book about play and the science of play. And I think that's one of those areas where everybody has intuitions that play is important for children and that children learn through play. But, you know, if you have a day where you have the Kumon scheduled and the, you know, Mandarin classes and the extra homework and the soccer practice, it just kind of falls out of the day. And it is genuinely true that in schools across the country, the recess time has shrunk and shrunk and shrunk, and the time for just free play has shrunk and shrunk and shrunk as there's this sense that we have to do more and more. And the interesting thing that comes out of the science is that what free, unguided, spontaneous play does for you is not make you better at any specific thing that you could go out and test. If you want someone to do something specific, you're better off getting them to actually do that, just train them to do just that one thing or teach them to do just that one thing. What play does is enable you to deal with change. It enables you to do something that no one's ever thought of before. It lets you explore the space, which is one of the reasons why it's been kind of hard to demonstrate the benefits of play, because there are these things like being able to think up something brand new, and it's pretty hard to have a standardized test in which you say, okay, now think of something brand new as an answer to this, question. But the data, I think especially some of the data from animals and young animals play too, is pretty clear about the benefits that play has in that context. And one of the biggest kind of policy issues that I talk about in the book that I think really comes out of the science is that, you know, go back to what we were saying about how could we recreate a context that would be really good for children, since we don't just have the spontaneous traditions anymore. You know, great preschools like the ones in the Reggio Emilia program in Italy and the Child Study Center at Berkeley, they're wonderful examples of exactly the garden that I'm talking about. And it's no coincidence that kindergarten was supposed to be a child's garden, not a preschool.
Yeah.
Those kinds of programs where there's sand and water and people to explore and things to find out about and caring adults who can help you along, that's kind of the perfect description. And the irony is that what's happened now is instead of taking those ideas and expanding them and making them available to more and more children, there's more and more pressure to make those kindergartens like school, yeah, make them into preschools, make them have the kind of pedagogical directed instruction that we have in schools. And that's just the opposite of what the science would tell us about how to have children as a whole who are innovative and creative and can do all these wonderful human things that children can do.
It seems like there should be lots of different kinds of people in the garden too, because you say human children are adapted to learn from different kinds of people.
Yeah. So one of the, again, if you're sort of contrasting the past and the present, one of the things that we know is that just, again, as part of the adaptation of being human, our chimps, for example, are pretty much taken care of by their biological mothers. And just in the course of becoming human, we greatly expanded the range of people who care for children. So not just biological mothers, but fathers and friends. And my personal favorite, grandmothers. Grandmothers didn't really exist before human beings. We're one of the few species where human women actually outlive their fertility. And there's more and more evidence that those grandmothers were really the thing that enabled us to have that long, protected childhood, which makes me happy as a grandmother.
You referred to Kristen Hawkes, who on this campus at the University of Utah, for example.
Yeah, that's right. Kristen Hawkes is right there at Utah, a fabulous, wonderful anthropologist. And she's done these terrific studies showing just how big a contribution the grandmothers are making. But there's another piece to that, which is it means that when children are growing up, they're getting to see lots of different people who care for them in lots of different ways, who have lots of different traditions and values. And with grandparents, they actually get to have kind of two generations worth of traditions and culture and values. And that diversity is what helps children to develop ideas like understanding what's going on in other people's minds and understanding all the variation of that. So the variation in the caregiving, which, again, we tend to think is sometimes that when we're parents, we tend to worry about, is everybody on the same page? That actually is another thing that allows for diversity. And the same thing's true about the children themselves. So having children who aren't all the same. I think anybody who's, you know, had more than one child has a sense of how different they are from the very beginning. That difference, that variability is something that really seems to help us human beings to adjust to all these different kinds of circumstances. And again, we have a tendency to act as if there's kind of one model, which is the way the person should be, and then if they don't have that, then there's something wrong with them. They're sick. They have a disease. We have to do something to cure them. So that natural cognitive diversity seems to be part of this evolutionary program that makes mess good.
Yeah, mess is good. Yeah. a point you make in the book. I wanted to ask about love, because this is another important component. You write this. You write, what makes us love a child isn't something about the child. It's something about us. We don't care for children because we love them. We love them because we care for them. Would you talk about that component, this idea of how we sort of have evolved this sense of love for children?
Yeah. So I also talk about this in the book. And again, when you have a biological mother, you can. This is another piece of my personal experience that I talk about in the book. You have hormones and changes in biological changes in your body, and the baby comes out, and you see the baby. When you're a grandmother, what happened to me, at least, is in the course of 2 weeks, I went from being exactly the same person to I went from being one person to being a person who now had a baby in their life who they would give their life for.
Yeah.
Without any of those kind of biological changes. And we actually have some evidence that caring for children, whether it's done by a mom or a dad or a grandmother or even just someone who's not related to the baby at all, does things like lead to the release of oxytocin, which is a hormone that makes us feel this kind of uncommitted love and trust to this, that makes us feel this unconditional love and trust and commitment to this particular baby. And in fact, there's a general idea that a lot of our attachments, our love of other people, really have their roots in these feelings, these relationships between caregivers and children. And it's a very special kind of love. I guess we celebrate it, but I think we could celebrate more deeply how unique it is that we commit so much to someone who's not going to give us anything in return. Yeah. It's a really different relationship than almost all the ones that philosophers have talked about when they've talked about ethics and morals. This fact that we take care of someone, and then as a result of taking care of someone, we love them, even though, sort of especially though, they're not in a position to give us benefits in return. I think that's actually pretty deep.
Allison Gopnik is with us, a professor of psychology and an associate professor of philosophy at the University of California, Berkeley. We're talking about her book, The Gardener and the Carpenter, What the New Science of Child Development Tells Us About the Relationship Between Parents and Children. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Allison Gopnik. We're talking about her book, The Gardener and the Carpenter. She's joining us from the studios of UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. I wanted to ask you about one of the chapters of the book. You explore what children learn by looking and by listening. So with the parenting model, parents kind of control learning in this really conscious way. But I guess the sort of more biological approach is different. We have this really long childhood, and so that allows for this really long period of learning. And so this idea of looking, of observing, comes into play. Would you talk about that part?
Yeah, this is one of the areas where there's just been this explosion of really fascinating research about how children are designed to learn just by observing the things that the other people around them are doing, the way that they use a tool or the way that they put one thing into another thing, the things that they do when they're talking to other people. And it turns out that children are really sensitive and intelligent about the way they learn just from watching someone cooking or cleaning or going to do the groceries, just the everyday things that we all do. And in fact, children learn better in many ways in that kind of situation than they do when someone sits down and says, okay, here, I'm going to tell you what the answer is. I'm going to teach you this particular thing. What happens is that when children are observing and looking and just paying attention to other people, they can figure out not just exactly what the person is trying to teach them, but exactly how the person works and how the world works. And they can use that to create new actions, new ways of doing things that are different from the ways that are obvious or that they've observed or imitated. So there's a couple of studies, one in my lab, one in a lab at MIT, for example, that are really, really great examples of this, where if you, say, just do a complicated series of actions as you're trying to figure out how a machine works, the children can look at that complicated series of actions and figure out, oh, okay, I can figure out what the very best thing to do would be. I can figure out a new intelligent strategy for solving this problem, for making this machine go. But when the experimenter says, I'm going to show you how my machine works, and then does all these complicated things, the children don't get to that intelligent solution. What they do is just imitate exactly what the experimenter did. So again, it's one of these ironies where just doing the things that you would do anyway is giving the children the right kind of information that they need to figure things out in an amazingly sophisticated, subtle, intelligent, creative kind of way, and doing what we think is going to help, which is being a teacher, having this kind of directed instruction picture, actually can narrow the range of options that children are willing to consider.
And kids are better at the observation part, it seems like, than the grown-ups. You write about, I can't remember which particular study it was, where the kids did better at this than the young kids, than the college kids.
Yeah, this is a whole line of research that we're doing in my lab now, and in a lot of different circumstances. For instance, if a machine works in a way that's kind of unexpected, that's not obvious, not the first way that you would think, the children are actually better at figuring that out, at discovering that the machine works that way than grown-ups are. And I think anybody who's sort of had a 2 or 3 year old who knows how to use your iPhone better than you do,
right,
has kind of seen that, where they figure out just by playing and messing around randomly, they figure out, oh, here's a way that this machine can work that I wouldn't even think about. I wouldn't even think about trying. An example of that that I think is interesting that's just happening now is, for instance, for me, the idea that you'd have a touch interface, that you could actually touch something and make it happen, that's like this weird, super fancy feature of a phone. For the children, that increasingly is just the assumption about how you interact with the world. You touch things and things happen. So they've got a really different picture about what the world is like than I do. And the children seem to be better at figuring out something that, for me, is kind of weird and unusual, like the fact that you could touch a screen and make something happen, is kind of second nature to the kids.
Which I actually want to come back to this idea, because there's a section about technology and all the hand-wringing that all of us grown-ups seem to be doing over the effect of screens and digital technology. But I wanted to ask you something else before we get there.
Right.
I was really interested in what you write about over-imitation and then human rituals. Would you say something about that? The idea of over-imitation, getting even to the really kind of fine details. I found that really interesting.
Yeah, so when children are going out and looking at people and learning by observing and learning by imitating, which is something they do from the time they're born, they're sometimes figuring things out, like how does this tool work or how does this machine work or why is this person, you know, why am I whipping up the eggs to make the souffle? But sometimes they're also learning just these rituals that we have, which is an incredibly important part of being human, the fact that, you know, we make pancakes the same way, the same time every Sunday morning, or that we put the forks on the we put the forks on the left, or we put the knives on the right, or we go to church, or we do all sorts of things that are these kind of rituals. And it's a really important part of being human. And it turns out that even 2 and 3 year olds are already very sensitive to, is this something someone's doing in order to get an outcome, or is this something that someone's doing as part of a ritual, part of a rule, part of the way that we do things here? And in fact, a brand new study that just came out suggests that children may even see rituals and rules in things that we don't see as being rituals or rules. And I think people, you've had this experience sometimes, right, where you know, do something one way. You did Christmas time, you put the Christmas tree in a particular place, and then the next year the children say, no, it has to be there. Yeah. That's the rule. That's right. The tradition. Even if it just started out being an accident that you did that, and now you're stuck with this tradition for the rest of your life. But the studies show that that's true, too, that children are really sensitive to tradition and culture and rule, and they're very good at figuring out when something just kind of an accident and when is something that's important to this culture and this community.
How is that important to them, do you think? I mean, you say it helps them identify, you know, who they are, what group they belong to, but this idea of ritual seems really important in what practical way in terms of how they learn?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And I think the sort of idea is that, again, one of the things that we do as human beings is often we can make an arbitrary rule. Like a good example is the fact that you drive on the right. There's no particular reason why you should drive on the right instead of driving on the left. And other places do just fine with everyone driving on the left. But the fact that everybody's on the same page, that everybody does the same thing, that everybody obeys the rule, that's actually really, really important for us to have these very complicated, coordinated activities that we all have. So, you know, some laws are about big moral principles, but a lot of laws are about, let's just make sure that everybody does this more or less the same way so that we can communicate and be on the same page. And these kind of rituals seem to serve a really important function for coordinating what people do, and also for telling you who you are. Yeah. So very often something like which side, whether you use your fork on the right or the left, that tells you something about who you are, what community you are. Are you a stranger or are you someone who people know? And figuring that out, figuring out who's my group and who isn't in my group, seems to be something else that kids are very, very good at doing from very, very early on, and is something very important to them.
And isn't it also important in some way that they have a more, as opposed to just a linear view of the world, that this they see something more abstract? Because you say that it's kind of like this, the idea of ritual and imitation, in some way it's more like dancing. It's more, you say this, it's a form of love, not work. So it's abstract. It doesn't have to have a practical outcome, I guess.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting that one of the ways that we show our love in a family, for example, is by having those rituals about the Sunday morning pancakes or about the Christmas tree or about the Passover dinner. We do all those things, and doing them all the same way on the same page is one of the ways that we can show that we're in the same world as other people. And if you think about language or dance or song, all those things are really important for bonding us together with the people that we love.
I'll bet you get tons of questions from people hand-wringing, as I said, about technology. But it seems like you're saying, get a grip, people. All generations make changes to the stuff that their parents developed. And I wanted you to relate this kind of, I thought, lovely parable in the book about this little girl whose parents give her this device when she's only 2. Would you tell that story?
Yeah. So here's what happens. The parents give the little girl this device. She's only 2 years old, and she becomes completely absorbed in this device. It's got this very powerful optic interface that means that information goes straight into her brain and transports her into this completely different alternate reality. By the time she's 6 or 7, a lot of her waking hours are just spent with this device, and she goes off into the garden and refuses to talk to anybody for hours at a time because she's so involved and engaged in this device. She even puts it under her desk at school. And by the time she's an adult woman, she just can't stand the thought of going anywhere without having this device. Every room in her house is full of the device. And when they actually do studies, they discover that the device has taken over big parts of her brain that were once used for something else are now just devoted to decoding the device. She does it automatically. And, you know, her child has a concussion and goes to the hospital, and the first thing she thinks of is, do I have the device with me? And then, of course, she gets her own children hooked on the device as soon as she possibly can. Now, that sounds like a horrifying story about a kind of technological dystopia, but it's actually autobiography. That's my relationship with the book.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I keep thinking about is every time someone's worried about something, about new technology, just think to yourself, suppose the book was something new. What would I say about books? They make people sit off by themselves. They stop people from interacting with other people. They're distracting. They're addictive. You find yourself reading when you should be doing other kinds of things, when you should be doing work and useful things instead. So I think what's happened is, and it's interesting that Socrates, the great philosopher, actually thought that writing was a terrible idea. Yeah. He thought that it would destroy our memories and it would keep us from interacting with other people. And of course, part of the moral is that he was right. I mean, reading did really change the way that people interacted with one another. It probably changed the course of history, lots of people think. And new technologies are likely to do the same thing. Children in the next generation are not going to be interacting with the world in the same way that we did. But that process is part of what it means to be human. Mm-hmm. And I think that generational differences, the fact that children are learning about technologies with these very open plastic brains, and we have to do it with this brain that's much more rigid, this adult brain, is part of the reason why over and over again you see these adult anxieties about what is this going to do to our children. And of course, that doesn't mean that you don't do anything about it. Just as with books, you had to sort of sort out what are the good books and what are the trashy books, mm-hmm. and what's a good way of curating literature and what's a bad way of curating literature. You give your children books that are good books and not books that are bad books. And I think in much the same way, when it comes to technology, we can curate, here's the parts that seem to be good and here's the parts that aren't. And here's the new institutions that we can have that will let us develop a healthy relationship with this new technology. But I think the idea that there's something about this time, this technology is scary and destructive, I don't think we have very good scientific evidence for that. And we have a lot of historical evidence that this is pretty much the way we feel anytime technology changes.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned we adults are, you know, we're judging the digital world based on something we came to as adults. We came to it later. You mentioned, like you said, a three-year-old who knows intuitively how to use a touch screen. They're judging mm-hmm. it differently. And I guess you have to take that into account when you think about all of this.
Yeah, I think the anthropologists have a nice phrase, the cultural ratchet. So the cultural ratchet is the way that each generation can take all the things that we learned in the previous generation for granted. So we think that all the technologies that we grew up with are just natural. They're not something that we think twice about. I was talking to someone the other day who said, oh, you know, in my house, children only have natural things like silk and wool and wood furniture. And I was thinking, yeah, not so natural from the perspective right. of the Pleistocene, right? Yeah. Every one of those things is the result of actually very advanced technology. It's just that that's all technology that we take for granted when we first encounter it when we're children. And then the ratchet is that each new generation has to develop new ways of being in the world, new tools, new kinds of technologies. And that's what we've been doing as mm-hmm. long as we've been human.
So I won't ask you to come up with some sort of formula, of course, for parents, because that's not what you do. But You say in the book that the trick is to provide kids with this, you know, rich, secure context that they need without expecting that you can sort of control the outcome. But you also say that you're not just saying go with the flow. I wanted you to say something about that finally, because you're telling caregivers they do need to pass on the rituals and traditions and values. They've got to find a way to do that as well, I suppose.
Yeah, so the picture that's coming out of the science and the picture that I'm talking about in the book isn't a picture of, you know, you just leave the children alone on a desert island and everything will be fine. We have lots of reasons to believe that that isn't true. So the same kind of diversity comes because parents are letting their children find out, learn, and children are hungry to learn about the things that are important to their parents and what they care about and what they know and what traditions they've got. But that idea that you're passing on the things that you value, passing on the knowledge that you have, is so different from the idea that you're shaping a child in a particular way. And again, I think the reassuring and liberating part is you can just do that by being the person that you are, by being the person you are with your values, with your skills, with your knowledge, and loving your child and giving the child to be with you as that person. That's all it takes to be successful as a caregiver. Now, as I say, all it takes, of course, it's incredibly sweaty, difficult, hard labor, exhausting, awake a lot, all the things that we all know about being a caregiver. So it's hard work, but it's hard work that lets a child bloom in the next generation. Again, a lot like being a gardener. Being a gardener is, you know, hard work, and you're sweating a lot, and you're up to your ears in manure a lot of the time, and it's messy and noisy and smelly, and nothing ever quite comes out exactly the way that you planned. But part of being a really good gardener is exactly that you want things to change enough so that they can adjust to the seasons and adjust to the weather, and a lot of the great satisfactions come because it's unexpected. You don't know exactly how it's going to come out. And I think that's, again, a healthier, thriving way of being involved with children. And one of the things I talk about in the book is, you know, the great thing about the science is we've discovered so much about what an amazing, remarkable miracle every single child growing up is. And as a caregiver, you get to be part of it and you get to observe it. And that's the thing that's really important about caring for children.
Alison Gopnik, book is The Gardener and the Carpenter, with the New Science of Child Development, tells us about the relationship between parents and children. Alison, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.